You are listening to People Rise Up on KBOO Community Radio here in Portland, Oregon, USA. My name is Andrew Geller, and today we are going to continue with the next in a many-part series called It Is Happening Here, which is going to look at each of 14 characteristics common to seven modern fascist states as described in an essay written by Lawrence Britt, which you can see at the People Rise Up website. Today, we're going to be looking at the prevalence or lack thereof of a controlled mass media here in the United States present day. Joining me to talk about this idea are author of many books, most recently War Made Easy, and syndicated columnist and KBOO alum, Norman Solomon. Welcome back to the program, Norman.
Good morning. Thanks, Andrew.
And also joining us is Brent Cunningham. He is the managing editor of the Columbia Journalism Review. And good afternoon to you.
Good morning. Afternoon, whatever.
So I just want to set out here, and in setting this up with you guys, we kind of all agreed that we're not going to really be discussing the concept of there being a extraordinarily centralized, coordinated, conspiratorial effort to control the mass media, but really more focus on somewhat of the understandings of the relationship primarily between government and media, but within the media mass media institutions themselves, of just kind of how things work. Now, one of the aspects of the Bush administration that seems to have really amplified is restricting access to information that it seems should be public. And I guess, why don't we just start out, Norman, you write about the media on a very regular basis, including being reprinted here in the Portland Alliance. How do you assess that idea, restricting access to information from government to the media?
That's a factor, there's no doubt. The Freedom of Information Act has been damaged in practice in recent years, actually in the last couple of decades. And also we have just the usual effort, probably much more accentuated in this administration than in some others, to try to withhold information. You know, if you look at Daniel Ellsberg's book, Secrets, among other things, and it is a great book, you'll find his observation that when he was in the Pentagon, reporters rarely had any inkling how often and how routinely they were being lied to. They thought they were getting candor. And I suspect that's even true today, even among many of the more skeptical reporters are just being lied to in terms of the withholding of information, as well as being spun in various ways. And if it's in sync with the spin that they're fairly comfortable with, then they may not even bristle at it. But I would add that often the administration is scapegoated for the self-censorship, the self-imposed or at least self-accepted constraints that journalists function within. And I'd give a couple of hopefully quick examples here. One is of what has been called a public secret. In other words, it's not a secret. Whether it wanted to or not, the executive branch out of the White House did not prevent the information from being publicly accessible. But the public, for the most part, never hears about it. And that's part of how, as you put it, Andrew, how things work. So here's a specific example. And let's go before the often demonized current Bush administration. In early 1999, the U.S. media was reporting about the Rambouillet negotiations in France about the upcoming conflict over Kosovo with the Serbian government. Mm-hmm. And there was the release of the text of the Rambouillet Accords that were being promoted by Secretary of State Albright and the Bush and the Clinton administration. And that text of the Rambouillet Accords had an Appendix B, and I'll briefly quote from it. NATO personnel shall be immune from any form of arrest, investigation, or detention by authorities of the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. NATO is granted the use of airports, roads, rails, and ports without payment. NATO shall have the right to use all the electromagnetic spectrum. What it boils down to is that NATO, in this provision, which was a poison pill part of the proposal being put as an ultimatum by Richard Holbrooke and the Clinton administration to Belgrade, NATO was to have essentially the run of the country. And just about any leader of any country is not going to accept that. And so it was rejected. Here's kind of the punchline. I did an exhaustive nexus search. This Appendix B was almost totally unmentioned until the end of the war, in which case the Washington Post on a back page, back paragraph, mentioned it in passing, calling it a little notice provision. Well, wearing my hat as executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, I know that for weeks and even a couple of months before that claim, we had faxed excerpts from Appendix B into hundreds of newsrooms. It was reported elsewhere in the world. This is an example of a public secret that the American people had the right to know that the administration had put this poison pill into the supposed good faith negotiations. We had 78 straight days of bombings of Yugoslavia, Kosovo, by the U.S.-led NATO forces as a result of the breakdown of those negotiations.
Now, Brent Cunningham, going hand in glove with the idea that information should be limited, and in terms of actually having access to the folks that you're working with in terms of coverage, if you're a Washington, D.C. reporter, for example, is the concept of skepticism and sort of having a speaking truth to power and challenging official pronouncements that is really key to a free and independent media. And I'm curious what you would say about the level of skepticism among mainstream journalists sort of in general, and maybe more focusing on print than radio or TV.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would agree with much of what Norman said. I mean, I think there's all kinds of things that are inherent in the way the mainstream press in this country operates today and has operated for some time now that allow an administration such as the Bush administration, which has aggressively sought to control information and to even bypass the press whenever possible, which has allowed them to do this more effectively than we might want. And I think the public secrets thing is a very good example of that. The whole question of access and at what price access, I think, is part of that as well. There's no doubt that access to sources is a legitimate concern for a beat reporter, whether it's at a little paper in Iowa or the New York Times and the Washington Post in D.C. It's legitimate, but I think it's also something of a crutch. You know, if the people you have access to, I mean, there's such an over-reliance on kind of official, the official point of view, kind of top-down news, particularly coming out of D.C., that when you're dealing with people at that level who are interested in creating their own reality or creating a reality that suits their interests, you know, I think you got to question the benefit of the access that you're trying to hang on to. And you know, I think in an ideal world we would see a much more of a kind of a decentralization of news gathering, if you will, where you cultivate sources deep in the bowels of a government agency, and news kind of bubbles up that way rather than just starting with the official pronouncement and then working out from there. So yeah, I mean, access, it's on the one hand it is legitimate. I mean, you have to some extent you have to have that access, but there is a real question, I think, that needs to be addressed about at what price and when that access starts to kind of work against you in terms of understanding the situation, whatever it may be.
You want to add anything about the concept of skepticism amongst reporters, Norman?
Well, the very good question, what price access, can be kind of cryptically answered with the name Bob Woodward. And, you know, we just see how, in many ways, as Walter Karp, who wrote for Harper's Magazine a couple of decades ago, pointed out, those who are often most acclaimed as the greatest investigative reporters are apt to be the most compromised. And Woodward is a good example.
Now, Brent, you referenced the concept of access via government channels in terms of, you know, maybe say like covering the war. It's important to be able to have access to folks at the Pentagon, executive office, etc. The Bush administration, and I'm reading here actually from a transcript from earlier this month, Democracy Now! Had Eric Bollert, author of Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush, and he cites the reasonably well-known idea that George W. Bush has had the fewest press conferences of any president in modern history, and that the sense of adversarialness, I suppose, if I can say that, has been increased, and there's actually even been threats made, as he describes it, to media people who maybe, say, step out of the bounds of what is understood to be the way things go there. Ari Fleischer noted a long time back that a particularly difficult question to I don't know who had been, quote, noted in the building. And if you're not granted the access to the folks you need to cover your beat, you're kind of in a difficult position regarding your job, so you're probably more willing to do whatever you need to stay in your position and be able to do the coverage you need.
Well, I guess that's true and not true. I mean, yeah, you do need some official access, but I mean, a really good, if we're just sticking with the run-up to the war in Iraq, I mean, I think a really good case in point is the piece that Jim Fallows did in The Atlantic, I think it was in the fall of 2002, called Iraq 51st State, which was all an exploration of likely aftermath scenarios of the war in Iraq, which was at the time virtually absent from the press, the mainstream press. And the interesting thing about that article was, one, that it set the agenda in terms of something that Washington wasn't interested in talking about, which is another kind of big issue that what we may get into here later in the conversation. But more importantly, his sources, Fallows' sources for that, were exclusively people outside of the administration. They were think tankers, they were retired military, they were people who had expertise in the region who were, you know, I'm sure that, you know, some of them had their own axes to grind, but it was basically a discussion of likely scenarios in the aftermath of the war, without, largely devoid of political spin. And so I think what that illustrates is that you can still do good work, and in some cases you're going to do the best work if you get away from the people who you think you have to have access to do your job. And I know this is a hard sell for a Washington White House correspondent, you know, to sell to his or her editors, but I think Dana Milbank at the Washington Post, formerly a White House correspondent there, probably did as good a job as you can in that kind of, boiler room environment of the White House press corps, at kind of, yeah, he got his official sources, but you know, he was to a certain extent blackballed by the White House because of his adversarial coverage. And you know, was it ideal? Was it perfect? No, but I think he would say that it worked for him. So yeah, I mean, you do have to have access. It's to do your job to some extent, but I think that it's, like I said originally, I think it can easily become a crutch.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO. My guests today are Norman Solomon, syndicated columnist and author, most recently of War Made Easy, and Brent Cunningham, managing editor of Columbia Journalism Review. You can find out more about each of them by going to the People Rise Up website, kboo.fm, click on Public Affairs, and you'll follow the link from there. We are featuring a discussion about controlled mass media, a characteristic of modern fascist states, according to an article written by Lawrence Britt, featuring 14 characteristics, and we're looking at all of those during the course of the year here on the program. This is characteristic 6. Let's get back to this and move from the issue of access to information and skepticism within journalists to briefly discuss the fact that within, I guess, more Washington-oriented, but I could see how it would replicate at smaller scales in other major metropolitan areas, are the personal relationships between members of the press, and the people they cover. Again, going back to the transcript with Eric Bollert from earlier in June on Democracy Now!, he references that Bob Schieffer, who's just now taking over from Dan Rather as CBS evening anchor, is good friends with George W. Bush, and was his brother was a business partner with Bush. Ted Koppel and Colin Powell, Tim Russert's good friends with the Rumsfelds and the Cheneys, Gwen Ifill at PBS Evening NewsHour, and Condoleezza Rice. And Eric Bollert cites, if you aren't in these circles, you have no idea about this. How do you see personal relationships, Norman, first, influencing coverage of these same people and their actions?
It's a factor. I mean, we could fill the next hour with examples. You know, you mentioned Ted Koppel. There's also Koppel and Henry Kissinger. There's Katherine Graham and Bob McNamara and Kissinger and on. I think it's a factor, but I think ultimately what's far more important is to do rigorous content analysis of what is in the paper and on the air. And it's much more important than whether they're friends or not, even though that is part of the stew that, you know, ends up giving you the media meal, so to speak. I.F. Stone was very clear about he wasn't into palling around with his official subjects of his writing. And I think it's something that we ought to look at, we ought to understand. More significant, though, I think, are shared sensibilities, which often go unspoken, whether they go to cocktail parties and hang out together or not. And I'd give a quick example. You know, I saw John Burns in Baghdad before the war, and I talked to him, and he was obviously a brave person, very smart, knew Iraq. Last night on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, he described as, quote, barbaric, unquote, what evidently was done to the two soldiers who have been found dead. And who could disagree? Of course it was barbaric. The problem is not that sort of description from a reporter at the New York Times. The problem is the refusal, because of sensibilities and kind of internalized worldview, the refusal of those reporters to ever be willing to describe what American firepower does to Iraqi civilians in public as barbaric. And so you have this kind of split screen of moral sensibilities. You know, if you lived in Fallujah in 2004 in April or November, you know, the argument that you weren't being aimed at would not carry much weight if your loved ones' bodies were being shattered or your own. And yet I cannot imagine John Burns going on national TV or any TV or radio or in his own articles describing U.S. military actions in Iraq as barbaric. It's just outside his frame of reference.
Well, and I just read something that said the exact same thing about the concept of having George Bush and the phrase war crimes to mean anything other than Bush championing the cause of pursuing war crimes against someone else somewhere else.
Well, you know, when I talk about these sort of constraints that function in news media, sooner or later somebody understandably says, well, you know, look, I see a lot of criticism of Bush in the U.S. press, and aren't you exaggerating? And you know, one way to respond to that is go to the best database for U.S. media you can find and search for op-ed articles of any sizable daily in the country that advocated that George W. Bush be put on trial for war crimes. And total up that number, and you'll find an index of the diversity of opinion in our news media.
Okay, now, you also brought something up here which we absolutely have to discuss, and that's the flat-out lying that has been not only... You know, it's, again, back to the idea of kind of an open secret. We all know that the government lies about certain things, and that we've seen recently that not only have journalists been seemingly increasingly, and I'll maybe get a sense of this from you here, Brent, that journalists have been increasingly caught lying, it seems, and not only that, but journalists, and I'm using that word sort of in single quotes, I guess, have been found to be actually paid by the administration to put forward stories and ideas supporting administration policies as seemingly independent journalists, when in fact they're being paid by the government to do this.
You're thinking of the video news releases?
Well, there's video news releases. There's Armstrong Williams. I forget the name of the woman that we found out.
Yeah.
And, I mean, Jeff Gannon, Guckert, whoever he is.
Yeah. Well, I guess I would make a distinction between the Armstrong Williamses of the world and, the people who are covering the White House for papers like the Washington Post and the New York Times. I don't think that they're the same animal, and I don't think that the notion of being bought and paid for, as far as message, being on message, is the same thing. I think that what you're describing, though, is this administration exploiting both the blurred lines between the entertainment world and the journalism world, which have been has been happening ever since we, became publicly owned companies. But also their kind of shameless pursuit of ways to bypass the legitimate media. So I think that's one issue. The other issue about identifying a lie and calling a lie, I think is much more interesting to me, because I think it gets at something that Norman was talking about, which is these shared sensibilities, which you might call class issues in the American mm-hmm. press today. And when you've got, and it also touches on the personal relationships. I mean, when you've got basically today, to be a member of the mainstream press, you are a member of the professional class. You're highly educated, you're reasonably well paid, and you identify with the lawyers and the other professionals who you come in contact with on a daily basis, whether it's in Washington or the State House in your given state or wherever. And you do have this shared sensibility about right and wrong and worldview, and you also have something that comes with kind of a middle class, upper middle class aversion to kind of things that are unseemly, which would be a public argument, being seen to argue with the president or the press secretary or the governor or the CEO. These are actually class traits that sociologists have written about, and you see it on display in the press today. So I think the squeamishness about calling a lie is in part class-based. I think it's also part of our adherence to some kind of warped notion of objectivity, which says that we're not to be seen arguing with the official, or we're not seen to be seen taking a side, which, if you pointed out a lie and called a lie, would be seen by many as taking a side. I think that's hugely problematic, and I would like to think that we're kind of weaning ourselves slowly from it, but you see it still every day. So I think this is the question of a lie, and it just raises so many issues for how the press operates. And I try to touch on a bunch there, but we could talk about any one of them for the full half an hour.
Yeah, as well as each of the other points here that we're not going to be able to address that I'm writing down. I looking through my materials here, Norman, it was an article of yours, April 4th of this year, where war crimes and Bush couldn't be viewed in the opposite direction. So wanted to attribute that. And actually, in a piece from mid-May, you reference exactly what Brent just talked about, and that's that in trying not to appear as though you are doing advocacy journalism by saying, we shouldn't allow wars to be entered into illegally based on lies and fraud, it is a form of de facto advocacy, the concept that silence is also, approving of, it's a silence is the voice of complicity, I guess, is the concept. We got a couple of minutes left. Do you want to reference anything related to that?
Well, the most powerful advocacy, so to speak, is by example, simply behavior that is put forward as being the ultimate professional way of doing one's job. And tacitly, often explicitly, one way or another, blending in with the prevailing scenery becomes the definition of professionalism, since it's a professional scenery. Euphemisms prevailing and all the rest of it. I would just say quickly, you know, that it didn't really much matter who was cutting the paycheck for Judith Miller when she was putting Ahmed Chalabi's stuff on the front page before the invasion of Iraq about WMDs. The fact that she didn't get any money from the government was not really very significant.
Okay, and I suppose we should just probably leave it there instead of diving into the concept of what doesn't the press look at? What is the impact of the fact that news operations over the course of the past 15 or so years have really shifted more into trying to be kind of infotainment and money-making operations, the impact of slashing employees in newsrooms, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? The show will cover these in other related topics in future episodes, but for today, thank you very much to both Norman Solomon, author most recently of War Made Easy, many, many other books, and syndicated media columnist. You can find out more about him online at www.normansolomon.org.com. Well, it's one of those. And Solomon is S-O-L-O-M-O-N. And also Brent Cunningham, the managing editor from Columbia Journalism Review. You can find out more about what they are up to at cjr.org. And make sure you also check out CJR Daily, which is their sort of daily news site. Thank you very much to both of you for being on the program this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew.
All right. Take care.
All right.
And that is going to wrap up our too brief look at the concept of controlled mass media here in the United States as part of It Is Happening Here, my year-long look at the prevalence of characteristics of fascist states here in the United States. If you have comments or questions about anything you heard on this or any of my other programs, you can email me, kboo@riseup.net. You can also go check out the People Rise Up website for links to the audio of this program, as well as links related to additional content online subject or pertaining to this subject. Go to kboo.fm, click on Public Affairs, follow the link to the People Rise Up page. Thank you very much for listening to this program. Coming up next, we've got Alone Rob hosting a special program on the World Cup, the tournament mesmerizing billions around the globe all month. At 11 on Democracy Now!, they'll focus on the movement to end violence against women across the globe. Guests are playwright and activist Eve Ensler, creator of the Vagina Monologues, and prison rights activist Kimberly Crenshaw. Stay tuned after this message for Alone Rob.
Press Watch will be on at a new time Thursday mornings, 30 minutes earlier at 9 o'clock. I'm Teresa Mitchell, inviting you to tune in at 9 a.m. Thursdays to examine all the stories that corporate media would rather spin or ignore. What's the latest on global warming, imperial wars, corporate-owned government, and the fascistization of the United States? Find out Thursdays at 9 here on KBOO, People-Powered Community Radio.